Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, in a minute or so, Stacey Philbrick-Yadov briefs us on why Yemen is dissolving into violent chaos. And at the bottom of the hour, Elizabeth Economy explains what's up with the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which China has founded and 47 countries have applied to join. Washington is not happy. First, Stacey Philbrick-Yadov. She is an assistant professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. Her writing on Yemen has appeared in the Marip Report and the Washington Post, and her book Islamists and the State was published in 2013. For several decades, Yemen was an authoritarian kleptocracy led by President Ali Abdullah Saleh. In 2011, as part of the Arab Spring, Yemenis rose up against his regime. A transition was organized by the Gulf Cooperation Council, whose member countries are Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. None of the models of democratic governance. Saleh's anointed successor was his vice president, Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi. Facing a rebellion by a group known as Houthis, Philbrick-Yadov will explain just who they are, Hadi left the country at the end of March, just as a Saudi-led Arab coalition launched airstrikes against the rebels. Of course, the U.S. has been conducting drone operations throughout Yemen for years. Here's Stacey Philbrick-Yadov with more.
I think I speak for many Americans when I say we really... You know, we see our government involved in military actions in Yemen. We see the country in the midst of chaos. But we really can't figure out the first thing about what is going on there. Where does one even begin to understand the current dilemma of Yemen?
It's really hard. I think one of the most pressing things to remember is that Yemen was in terrible shape before this campaign began. And it's really hard to imagine how really a major war is going to help with the kind of underlying problems that Yemenis were facing before the crisis. It's also, of course, always the case with Yemen that alliances shift very quickly, and anyone who tries to game that process by predicting who's going to side with whom is really usually doing so on the basis of faulty assumptions, on assumptions about what the foundations of political identity are, what role identity actually plays as opposed to material interests in motivating people's alliances and so forth.
Let's go back, I don't know, I guess to the Cold War when the country was divided in North and South, South allied with the Eastern Bloc. What were things like in those days?
Well, it's interesting. Sheila Karapiko has argued pretty persuasively that the economies of the two states didn't actually look radically different, in part because in the North, even though there was a formal commitment to capitalism, there was still such a huge sort of development need that the state played a pretty aggressive role in trying to promote economic development. In the South, obviously, there was a statist orientation already because it was a Marxist government. But they never actually stamped out all market activity, particularly in the Hadramaut region, where there was like a long-standing sort of merchant class that was never really brought to heel under Marxist economic principles. So the two economies didn't look all that different. But one of the big motivators of unification in 1990 was certainly the development of natural resources along the North-South fault line.
And what sort of resources do they have there?
Oil and natural gas. And the problem with Yemen is that, well, I shouldn't say the problem with Yemen, that's ridiculous, but the problem with resource dependence in Yemen is that the Yemeni economy is heavily dependent on those resources, but the resources themselves are a small drop in the bucket in terms of global production. So Yemen's oil is pretty irrelevant to outside actors, but it's really relevant to internal dynamics.
And the country overall is rather poor, isn't it?
Extraordinarily so, absolutely. Per capita income is about $1,200, and Yemen is reliant on imports for 90% of its wheat, 100% of its rice. Oxfam estimated before this war that over 60% of the population was in need of immediate humanitarian assistance.
How did it get to be in such poor shape?
Very poor political institution, to be sure, and not very much industrial development. Yemen has a problem with water resources, but I would suggest that in general, stronger political institutions would have been able to address a lot of these development challenges. One substantial problem, and that relates to this current conflict, is that for many, many years, the international community has essentially deferred to Saudi Arabia on Yemen. And Saudi Arabia has used Yemen as a source of cheap labor when it's convenient, and engaged in massive deportations of Yemeni workers when it's inconvenient.
Relying on Saudi Arabia seems like a poor bet. What is the Saudi interest other than a source of cheap labor? Is there anything?
No, I think Saudi Arabia has been interested. It's interesting. I think they've been interested in a model of stability that relies on substantial instability, by which I mean they keep a finger in pretty much every pie in the hopes that however things shake out domestically in Yemen, they will have a relationship with whoever comes out on top. And that's been standard practice for a long time. So throughout the 1990s and the 2000s, they backed both the Saleh regime, elements of the Saleh regime, and also elements of the political opposition. So no matter how things shook out, they would be okay. The Houthis have complicated that because of the putative ties to Iran. And I don't mean to dismiss the ties to Iran, but I think we can see right now that Iran is not willing to do tremendously much to support the Houthis. There's a lot of distance between them ideologically. I think the Iranians have been interested in the Houthis primarily as the Houthis have been ascendant, and if they're not ascendant or they are substantially politically inconvenient to Iran, that relationship will wane. But it has provoked tremendous anxiety for the Saudis, and I think we see that in this current conflict, certainly, but also even in the way that the transitional agreement after 2011 was structured.
Now, is there a colonial history that helps explain the current situation in Yemen?
Not really. Yemen was never thoroughly colonized. So the part of the country that became North Yemen or the Yemen Arab Republic was a kind of dual governance situation between Ottoman authorities and a Zaydi Imamate, or essentially a Zaydi monarchy. And in the south, certainly there was a colonial legacy, but it was various in different parts of the south. So indirect rule outside of the city of Aden, direct rule in the city of Aden. So it's impossible to say that Yemen has a single historical legacy. And that, of course, is very much at play in why it's so deeply divided today. These differences in regional histories matter a great deal.
What about the ethnic picture, demographics, language, languages? What does Yemen look like socially?
So for the most part, everybody is an Arabic speaker. There are some local languages that differ, but that's not a major barrier. It's an ethnically Arab community, certainly ethnically dominant. And the small groups that are not Arab are heavily peripheral, but they are also peripheral to the ongoing conflict. So this is an intra-Arab conflict. The sectarian dimension is interesting. I'm not comfortable talking about it in purely ideological terms. To me, certainly this Zaydi or the Sunni-Shi'i distinction is far too blunt, right? But within those broad categories, we can talk about Zaydis and Shafi'i Sunnis and Salafi Sunnis. And the most important thing, I think, to recognize is that it's been about access to institutional power. So these communities lived alongside each other. Certainly the Zaydis and the Shafi'i Sunnis lived alongside each other for a very long time without any major sectarian dimension or a sectarian conflict. And then beginning in the 1980s, there was a major influx of Salafi evangelism in the north. And you started to see lower status Zaydis getting literally picked off by the Salafi evangelists, converting, if you will. And it began to polarize the climate in the far north near the Saudi border. In that context, as Zaydis were converting, there was also then a Zaydi revivalist movement. But that revivalist movement was still articulated in terms of political institutions. They were turning to the government and saying, hey, could you actually regulate these evangelical schools maybe and try to give us some kind of cultural protection so that we're not facing this kind of onslaught? And the government didn't do that. In fact, the government not only didn't exercise oversight over these evangelical institutions, but gave them support. So that really, I think, was driving this sectarian conflict that sort of came out of nowhere. I mean, it certainly came out of a history of coexistence, so that the Salafi evangelism was a tipping point there. In the more contemporary period, the structuring of the 2011 transitional agreement rewarded the Salafi camp through the Islah Party and excluded the Houthi movement from the transitional government, and I think really gave Houthis and Zaydis more broadly some real concern about what kind of institutional voice they were going to have in the transitional process.
Those evangelists you spoke of, were the Saudis behind that?
Yes, absolutely.
Religious passion or political influence?
I think both, right? It was absolutely, some of it was premeditated support for Salafi evangelism that Saudis have engaged in any number of countries. And some of it was more organic, the return of Yemeni workers who had been in Saudi Arabia, and, you know, close to a million were deported during the first Gulf War and sent back to Yemen en masse, and they brought with them new ideas, new experiences that they had developed in Saudi Arabia. And so some of it was more organic, some of it was more deliberate, but the sort of ground zero for that evangelical conflict was the province of Saada in the north, which is really has traditionally been the Zaydi heartland.
You mentioned 2011, the Arab Spring, which is seems like a quaint label. What was the manifestation of that upsurge in Yemen?
Well, Yemen's uprising was somewhat unique. I mean, all of them are. Any regional specialist is going to tell you what makes the specific uprising in the country they specialize in unique. But I will do that anyway, right, and say Yemen had a populist uprising. It lasted about 11 months. It was interesting because the organized formal opposition had an uncomfortable relationship to the populist upsurge. But what really, I think, made it quite distinctive is that the military split, and therefore both protesters and regime loyalists had factions of the military on their side and had tribal militias on their side. So what we ended up with was a situation where there was armed conflict and at the same time unarmed protesters who amazingly managed to remain unarmed and committed to a civil state throughout that 11-month period. When the transitional agreement was brokered by the Gulf Cooperation Council, and we should start by saying the Gulf Cooperation Council could never have been considered an honest broker in a democratic transition. That's sort of absurd on its face. There isn't a democracy among them, and I don't understand why it's even called a transitional agreement. But when that agreement was signed, it was signed at the very top between the formal opposition and the remnants of the Saleh regime, and it left a lot of people out. It closed people out. Let's say it left out the populist protesters because they were inconvenient to the organized parties, and it closed out the Houthis and that was really a grave mistake.
I'm speaking with Stacey Philbrick-Yadov, who teaches at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. What was that regime that was being uprisen against?
I mean, it was an authoritarian regime that existed for more than 30 years, but in comparison to other countries in the region, Yemen had always been a pretty politically vibrant place, and since 1990 there has been multi-party competition, etc. But the opposition parties, which became more strident in their opposition, also became less capable, less effective as an organized political opposition. So it existed, this partisan opposition, but had been really functionally unable to challenge President Saleh from at least 2009, when they agreed to delay the parliamentary elections. Yemen hasn't had a parliamentary election since 2003, and its parliamentary election in 2003 was the least fair of the rounds of post-unification elections that they've held since 1990. Parliament, as it exists, is strongly a pro-Saleh parliament, and parliament has been used in the transitional period to validate all kinds of public policy decisions that don't enjoy wide support.
This transitional period is what, 3-4 years old? What's being transitioned into?
Right. I think at best, the expectation was that the transitional government was going to transition Saleh out of office and President Hadi into office. Now, President Hadi was President Saleh's vice president. So, you know, that's the mark of the GCC agreement, or the mark of the GCC on the transitional agreement. More bothersome, of course, is the fact that the United States and the European Union and the United Nations all threw themselves behind this transitional agreement as well. And I think that that's particularly problematic. The agreement offered President Saleh legal immunity, which was incredibly polarizing to protesters. And it also stipulated that presidential elections would come before parliamentary elections. So it was a continuation of this centralization around a single figurehead. And it stipulated that President Hadi would be jointly endorsed by both members of the former regime and the opposition. So effectively, in 2012, President Hadi was not elected. He was selected as an uncontested presidential candidate. So his legitimacy really owes to an international framework, not to domestic sources of popularity or legitimacy. In fact, opposing the Houthis probably is the closest he's been able to come to generating some domestic legitimacy on the ground. And that's also polarizing because they have some legitimate supporters as well.
And the Houthis, who are they?
The Houthis, the Houthi movement comes out of this Zaydi revivalist movement in the far north. It started out as a group of summer camps and schools under the label Believing Youth to counter the Salafi evangelism that I described. But by 2004, they had become a group of militias that fought six wars with President Saleh. In 2010 already, the Saudis engaged in airstrikes alongside President Saleh against the Houthis. Of course, today, President Saleh has now aligned with, former President Saleh has now aligned with the Houthis. So as I said at the very outset, alliances are extremely volatile, if you will, or difficult to predict at the least.
And there's an Al-Qaeda affiliate on the scene. What are they up to?
Right. So you've got two different groups that I would mention in that context. One is Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which appears to be pretty much sitting back and watching right now, letting other people fight these wars for them. But they have engaged in many attacks on the Yemeni military over the past several years and some attacks on civilians. Their primary goal appears to be to prevent government assertion of authority in regions where they have been able to operate. They do not appear to have what I would call a local governance agenda. They don't appear to be attempting to govern or rule or establish institutions in the areas where they're operative. By contrast, Ansar al-Sharia, which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Ansar al-Sharia does have a local governance objective and did establish real pockets or enclaves in parts of the South in particular, but was pushed back in many cases by popular committees, by self-organizing groups on the ground that pushed back their effort. One thing to bear in mind always is that Yemenis are, as you will read anywhere, very heavily armed on a per capita basis and quite accustomed to fighting because the central government has been largely incapable or unwilling to provide security for a very long time. So that does mean that when a group like Ansar al-Sharia pops up, there are people who are going to take them on, and that has happened already.
What, if any, are the popular bases of these Al-Qaeda affiliates?
Well, I don't think that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has what I would call a popular base per se, although U.S. drone strikes, which escalated dramatically after 2010, certainly fuel anti-American sentiment and have been reported to develop some sympathies for AQAP. Ansar al-Sharia, I think, is quite different. It came up in a climate of profound government incapacity following the 2011 uprising, and stepped in to really provide some local governance in places where there wasn't really literally none. People ultimately have pushed back against Ansar al-Sharia, but they had supporters on the basis of providing law and order in specific places where no one else was doing that job. So I think the social basis is different for the two groups.
And what has the U.S. drone campaign done for politics?
Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has first and foremost been a threat to Yemenis, right? Far more than projecting any power or threat outside of Yemen. They've been a threat to Yemenis because they've attracted the drone strikes. And so in that sense, both the presence of al-Qaeda and the presence of the drone strikes have been locally destabilizing. It's Yemeni civilians who are paying the costs for that. And so the drone strikes are very unpopular. They certainly, most Yemenis that I know would be very happy to see al-Qaeda leave Yemen, but they certainly have no love for a president who has ceded Yemeni sovereignty so clearly to the U.S. government in the form of this type of counterterrorism cooperation.
Now we have Saudi Arabia on the attack. What's that all about, and what are the effects of that going to be?
Well, the effects are going to be terrible, and I think it's not clear what Saudi's end game is in this regard. There was an effort to restart some negotiations in Riyadh. The Houthis do not want to participate in that. The aerial bombardment is coming from Saudi, but they've also massed ground troops on the border. The sea routes are basically closed off by the Egyptians. Yemen is functionally under siege in this regard. At the same time, during this campaign, the Houthis have managed to close off the port city of Aden, where the president was for a while, and he's now left. But they've made some real territorial gains on the ground, so it's not clear that the bombing campaign is even achieving the objective of hemming in the Houthi militias. But one particularly perilous thing is, as I mentioned before, you know, the humanitarian situation was already very bad before this war started, and now the Saudis are closing off the country to humanitarian aid. So the International Committee of the Red Cross reported today that they have a plane full of medical equipment and a team of surgeons that are trying to get into the country, and the Saudis have closed the airspace and won't let in the humanitarian aid. So in terms of what's going to come of this war, it's quite clear that things are going to be substantially worse off. President Hadi continues to think that he's going to govern Yemen when this is over. It's really hard for me to believe that. I don't really know when this is going to be over, but when it is, lines in the sand will have been, I think, more firmly dug. The country will be more polarized and in a much more perilous humanitarian situation.
And the Saudis doing this on their own, or is the United States okaying it?
Well, the Saudis have put together a coalition, and that coalition, a coalition of Arab partners, and that coalition has the support now of the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic Conferences. So they've sought sort of regional support for this coalition. The United States is providing some tactical and material support for the campaign. So certainly I think that we should be considered an antagonist in this conflict, but not as directly, certainly as the Saudis and the Egyptians, who are taking the lead.
This all sounds almost on the verge of hopelessness. Is there a way out of this, or are we just so far down the road to chaos that it's hard to imagine one?
It's really bad. I mean, I'm not a person who's going to say there's no way out of it, because at some point fighting does stop, right? But the question, I think, is not only when that happens, but what's left, and who does the negotiating when that happens. When I look at this today, I see this as the long result of a terrible transitional agreement. And that transitional agreement certainly was brokered by the GCC and backed by the United States and the United Nations, with some support as well from Europe. But the Europeans were at a greater distance. The Europeans are the only actors that I can see right now who might have enough credibility to pull off some kind of negotiated ceasefire or settlement. I don't see the United Nations having the good faith of the Yemeni antagonists in this conflict.
That was Stacey Philbrick-Yadov, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was Son of a Thousand Tongues, featuring Deirdre Muro, a Lorna Doone remix of a Missy Mazzoli composition from a new album, Vespers for a New Dark Age. We'll hear more Mazzoli at the end of the show. Next, Elizabeth Economy. Over the last few weeks, the world of international political economy has been watching a drama around the Chinese-founded Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which, as its name suggests, is meant to help finance infrastructure development around the Pacific. The U.S. was very unhappy with this arrangement, seeing it as a Chinese challenge to U.S. dominance of global economic development. It urged its allies not to join, but most European countries, including the normally pliable U.K., applied for membership anyway. Here's Elizabeth Economy, director of the Asia Program at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, to explain it to us from the point of view of a thoughtful member of the establishment. During the interview, Economy dismisses my assertion that the World Bank has lost a considerable bit of prominence over the years, but I'm right. In political terms, nothing compares to its political visibility and power during the debt crisis and restructuring days of the 1980s and 1990s. And in pure monetary terms, its new lending commitments last year were 16% lower than they were in 1999 without adjusting for inflation. If you do adjust for inflation, its new commitments are over 40% lower than they were 15 years earlier. So yes, the World Bank is not what it used to be. Okay, here's Elizabeth Economy.
First of all, what is the Asian Infrastructure Bank? What's its history? When did the Chinese come up with the idea?
Chinese came up with the idea, I guess, about a year and a half ago, and the purpose was to develop a bank that would be particularly targeted toward meeting the really extraordinary infrastructure needs of Asia. So part of it was simply the fact that the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, traditional lending institutions really didn't have the capacity to meet the needs of the infrastructure for Asia over the next decade or more. And part of it, of course, was the fact that China had been not shut out, but its voice was somewhat limited in the traditional lending agencies like the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. And so the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank was an opportunity for China to really assume a leadership role in the international financial architecture.
Parenthetically, I mean, it seems like the World Bank has sort of slipped out of the news lately. It doesn't seem as prominent as an institution as it once did. Why are they unable to deal with Asia's infrastructure needs? It doesn't seem like they kind of a whole lot of other business going on.
No, the World Bank is quite busy. Of course, it got a new president not that long ago, the former president of Dartmouth College, and I think he has been busy sort of reorganizing the bank internally and trying to make it more efficient. But certainly the World Bank is very active. I think the reason we don't hear much about it is because, it's a traditional institution. It continues to do its job. The reason that it can't meet Asia's infrastructure needs is simply it doesn't have the reserves to do it. The infrastructure needs of Asia are just so enormous, hundreds of billions of dollars, that no one bank can really service that. And so the idea is that here you'll have an infrastructure bank that will be particularly targeted toward Asia. But I don't think it represents sort of the diminution or the loss or of the World Bank.
It does seem, however, that the U.S. government is viewing the Asia Infrastructure Bank as a rival to the Bretton Woods institutions and particularly to a U.S. dominance of the international development process. Is that a fair anxiety for Washington to exhibit?
I think, the way that Washington, the administration, approached the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank was mistaken because they did assume that it was a sort of a threat to U.S. dominance. And in fact, it's not really U.S. dominance. While, U.S. typically holds leadership within the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank is headed by a Japanese. So it's not that the United States heads all of development financing. But they did view it as a threat, on the one hand, emanating from China. On the other hand, there were legitimate concerns about the governance sort of structures within the bank. Would there be transparency and, would you have good environmental practices and labor and social? Would you ensure that the lending took place, under sort of the highest of international governance standards? Because, frankly speaking, China in all of its bilateral assistance
has not done that, right? Has not operated with transparency and with best practices. And so I think there was legitimate concern that the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank would simply replicate China's way of doing business, which is, you know, not something that, you know, any of the advanced industrialized countries, and frankly many of the developing countries, would want to see. But I think the U.S. mishandled the concern, and, you know, rather than say, let's work together to ensure that, that best practices come into place, it just said, don't join. So I think it was a mistake.
A friend of mine who spent many years at the World Bank said he was amused by these U.S. objections, given the history of the institutions lending to people like Mobutu and Marcos.
Yes, that is absolutely true. When you look back through, and you know, U.S., even not even just the World Bank history, but U.S. lending history, that there are many, you know, sort of dark stains on our own past. That's quite true.
But in any case, despite U.S. objections, Britain, Australia, South Korea, France, Germany, even Taiwan have applied to join the bank. What, 47 applicants as of the deadline? It doesn't seem that the U.S. Really won many hearts with this campaign, with the exception perhaps of Japan.
No, I don't think the U.S. won any hearts. And Japan has its own self-interest. So even though the Prime Minister Abe is saying that, you know, the move, the decision not to, to join reflects sort of its alliance with the United States, you know, Japan has the Asia Development Bank, and so it has its own concerns about what the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank might mean for the ADB. So it has its own self-interest here. But quite right, the U.S. failed entirely in its effort to form a sort of coalition that would not join the bank.
And what about more broad Japanese concerns about growth of Chinese power? Is that figure in the decision?
I don't know whether the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, I think Japan's concerns about the growth of Chinese power are largely, although not entirely, but largely on the security front. I mean, China already surpassed Japan as the second largest economy in the world. I think it's important to note that, you know, if you look throughout Asia, while China is often the largest trading partner in Asia with many of the countries, actually Japan is a much larger source of foreign direct investment throughout Asia. You know, it has basically twice the level of investment that China does. So Japan is a quiet power within Asia. It doesn't make as much noise. It doesn't get as much attention. But actually, it's far more important in many respects to the economies of Asia than China is when you're looking at investment. So I think that, you know, was there some concern? Sure. But if you really want to understand the source of Japanese concern with the rise of Chinese power, it would be in the security front.
Yeah, Abe is making noises about lifting the constitutional restrictions on military spending. How significant is that? What do you see that the longer-term attention of that is?
Well, I think it's one of the things that the Chinese are most worried about, and I think it's, you know, one of the unintended consequences of China's flexing its muscles in the South China Sea and the East China Sea has been the rise of these other powers, not just Japan, but also, you know, India, Vietnam, many other Asian middle and large powers beginning to flex their own muscles. And Prime Minister Abe's, you know, raising of the issue of Japan's defense is a big part of this, and the Chinese are quite concerned about it, and in fact think that the United States doesn't pay proper attention to what an unleashed Japan, an untethered Japan might mean over the longer term.
And then back to this investment bank. Of course, a lot of people, I think, rightly or wrongly, are reading this as an instance of the increasing conflict between the U.S. and China. China is a rising power, U.S. is a stagnant or declining power. Is there too much melodrama in that reading, or is there something to it?
I think the U.S. constructed the drama, you know, and now it's facing the embarrassment of it. But in the overall scheme of things, I think it's a blip. And I think to say that China is a rising power and the U.S. is a stagnant power is probably not an accurate reading of what's going on in the region, where I think actually the rebalance or the pivot has had a not insignificant impact if you look in areas like the security area, or even if you look at governance and political issues and the U.S. engagement in things like, you know, smart cities or, you know, urban planning or women's empowerment, a lot of ground-up work that's being done in the development side of things by the United States. And if the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, comes to fruition, which I am relatively optimistic about, I think that will be a very clear statement of U.S. Continued, you know, the continued importance, if not sort of dominance of the U.S. in the region. So I'm not prepared to say that the U.S. is out of the game here. But I am prepared to say that the U.S. badly mishandled this AIIB issue.
And Chinese intentions over the longer term, they've been, of course, investing like crazy, making resource deals of various sorts around the world. Does the infrastructure bank fit into this kind of, I don't know, call it economic diplomacy that the Chinese are undertaking?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when you look at China, you know, especially in the region, since it is an Asian infrastructure investment bank, you know, they really have sort of, you know, three parts to their diplomacy. The first is the development of, you know, institutions like the AIIB or like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The Chinese have also proposed, you know, a new Asian security architecture and a new free trade agreement, you know, for the region. So they're very much interested in building up, you know, institutions. And the second is, you know, this sort of idea of the Silk Road and the Maritime Silk Road, which is a kind of, you know, building up of the infrastructure in Asia, roads and railroads, ports, energy infrastructure. It's kind of all roads lead to Beijing. And so the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank very much complements their sort of desire to develop this very wide-ranging, extensive infrastructure, hard infrastructure. So you have institutional infrastructure and hard infrastructure. And then the third strand is really their security policy, but that in some respects undermines, I think, their much more positive economic diplomacy, because their security posture has definitely served to agitate and to, you know, encourage other countries in the region, not only to look to the United States, but frankly to look to each other, right? So you have India and Vietnam and Australia, all these countries, and Japan forming security and economic relationships among each other, not that engage the United States necessarily, but just, you know, bilateral and trilateral arrangements to counter China. So I think while China is making very positive moves on the economic front, its security posture is really undermining some of what it's trying to do economically.
What is that security posture? Is it just seeing acting more bellicose to in the eyes of its neighbors?
Well, I think it's not simply acting more bellicose, but actually there's a design behind it, and that is, I think President Xi Jinping has moved from the policy of his predecessors, you know, dating back to Deng Xiaoping at least, of sort of staking out claims, right? So saying that, you know, the nine-dash line, which, you know, represents 90% of the South China Sea, the maritime territory of the South China Sea, and then the East China Sea with Japan, the Senkaku and Diaoyu Islands, saying that, you know, these are our sovereign territory, to actually trying to realize those claims. Right, so it's, you know, he established the air defense identification zone in the East China Sea, which basically said, you know, this entire area, if you want to fly through it, you have to ask permission, you have to give notification, and that affected, you know, Japan, South Korea, the U.S., you know, all of whom said we're not going to do that except for commercial flights. You know, they're doing all this reef reclamation in the South China Sea, right, dredging sand and putting out cement and concrete and building landing strips on these, you know, uninhabited islands and saying, okay, these are ours, and sort of really laying physical claim to what previously had just been a rhetorical claim to sovereignty. So I think it's more than simply acting bellicose. I think there's very much a war of attrition going on here in the South China Sea in particular.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Economy of the Council on Foreign Relations. Where do you see that going? Are they just trying to expand their sphere of influence, or is this, how much expansionism is there behind these deeds?
There's an enormous amount of expansionism because, again, this is 90% of the South China Sea. And so even countries that don't have a maritime conflict in the South China Sea with China, such as Indonesia, have said, we don't recognize these claims of China. They are not anywhere supported by international law. And so, again, you know, China is pushing out and laying claim. It's, I mean, there are resources at stake, of course, you know, fisheries, there's oil and gas reserves. But I think more than that, it's just a sense in the mind of Xi Jinping that this is China's, you know, core interest, its sovereign territory, and it is simply reclaiming what is rightfully its territory.
And elsewhere, I mean, the Chinese have been very active investing in places like Africa to secure resources, but how much political strategy is behind that as well? It's not just, is it just resource hunger, or is it influence hunger as well?
Well, I think China has a very long-standing you know, traditional relationship with many African countries dating back to the 1960s. So it's been engaged politically for decades. That's not new. The sort of drive for resources is something, you know, to fuel the Chinese economic growth is something that we've seen more in the past probably decade and a half. And it's not simply Africa, it's Latin America, it's, you know, Southeast Asia, it's the whole developing world, and increasingly it's countries like the United States and Canada and Australia. So really, I think the primary motivation here is economic. I think the hope on the part of China was that, you know, through this economic diplomacy, you know, that in some cases they're reviving mines that, you know, no other country, no other company was interested in working in. So they're, you know, ostensibly bringing jobs and other opportunities that otherwise wouldn't exist. They contribute to develop the infrastructure in many cases throughout these countries, and oftentimes they'll toss in, you know, a new presidential palace or foreign ministry as sort of a side benefit of doing business. So I think there is a political component as a part of broader diplomacy, but primarily the driver has been economic. I will say that in some cases, it hasn't worked out exactly like the Chinese would have liked. I mean, you can look and see in places like Zambia or Myanmar, for example, where you have a change in government. Again, this goes back to the idea that the way that China does business isn't necessarily transparent, isn't it, you know, sort of at highest levels of environmental and labor practices, so that when you have the changes in government in these countries, China is viewed as, you know, allied with, you know, a previous corrupt and oppressive regime. And so it ends up in some kind of political trouble. And many companies, there have been many instances where there have been demonstrations against Chinese companies and against China in these resource-rich countries because of the way these companies do business. And so it hasn't necessarily been a complete positive for China diplomatically. And frankly, on the economic front, you know, a Chinese mining official came out maybe about a year or so ago and said that roughly 80% of Chinese mining investments overseas were money losers. So, you know, it certainly grabbed a lot of headlines, China's resource quest. It's certainly had, you know, significant impact in many parts of the world. But in terms of its overall, what it's brought to China overall, it's not uniformly positive.
Okay, and then back to the infrastructure bank. A cynic might look at this and say, this is just a way for China to finance business for its own contractors, construction companies and such, engineering companies. How much of that is there in this infrastructure bank?
No doubt there is an element of China. I mean, this is something that China is good at, right? It's sort of developing infrastructure. And so, no doubt, having an Asian infrastructure investment bank that is half-financed by China, I think the Chinese leadership very much sees this as an opportunity to, you know, do further business and to, you know, export its construction and, you know, energy efforts. But, you know, the other half of this investment bank is made up of, you know, 47, 50 other countries. And so they all have their own companies and their own interests that they are now going to be advancing. And so the real question is going to become, you know, how is the voting structure developed? You know, how are bids sort of determined? You know, who wins a bid? So all of those governance practices, not just on the sort of environment and labor side and transparency side, but actually the fundamentals of it, I think have yet to be determined. As far as I know, there's not a clear determination over whether China has said that it's going to hold on to a veto within the bank. I've heard conflicting reports on this issue. So, yes, absolutely, China sees the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank as an opportunity to export its own business capabilities, some of its own strengths, but there are a lot of other countries that play in here as well.
Yeah, and all these other applicants, I mean, the varying levels of development, what's their interest in joining this bank?
Well, certainly some of them, you know, also have companies that, you know, are interested in, you know, gaining access. I mean, you know, Germany has its own railroad train. Siemens, you know, builds railroad cars. They have their own interests in trying to get a leg up for their companies. I think some countries like India might see themselves primarily as recipients, you know, contributing, but also primarily as recipients of this infrastructure. So I think it's a mixed bag. And China has been, again, through the on the trade side, has been a very significant engine of growth for the region. You know, China is second largest economy in the world. And so I think a lot of countries want to hitch their wagons to China in this regard.
I was surprised to see Taiwan on the list of applicants. What's that mean? Is this no longer a non-country in Chinese eyes, or is their application going to be rejected? And what are the Taiwanese looking for?
You know, I think, you know, Taiwan is always seeking to join international organizations. It tries to join, you know, every international organization it possibly can as a mechanism of expanding its own international space. I think the question for Taiwan joining the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank will be, how does Taiwan join, under what conditions? You know, what is the name that Taiwan has? Is it Chinese Taipei? Is it the Republic of China? Is it Taiwan? These are the kinds of issues that bedevil Taiwan when it looks to join international agreements and organizations. So, I mean, Taiwan wants to, you know, Taiwan is a thriving, you know, business community. It wants to be part of this game as well. You know, it's its own economic powerhouse, Taiwan. So it wants in. But for Taiwan, it has additional political considerations.
And finally, you wrote a book about 10 years ago on the Chinese environmental crisis. This talk of infrastructure finance would have, one might think, some kind of environmental angle. Will that figure in the portfolio of this bank?
I think it's going to be very much dependent on, it'll come up in different ways, right? Of course, in terms of the infrastructure, as Asia is modernizing, they're going to have need for things that relate to, you know, wastewater treatment, that relate to the environment. You know, my concern, frankly, will be that it will push faster, the process of urbanization and infrastructure development will push faster than sort of the environmental element of it, you know, so that the rest of the region might develop much the way that China has developed, right, without much consideration for the environment. And that's why I think it is important that you have these countries like Australia, like the UK, like Germany, hopefully, you know, in there to ensure that not only for any particular project are environmental considerations taken into account, but in terms of the overall process of infrastructure development, that sufficient consideration is given to environmental concerns. So I do think it's an enormous risk, frankly, because you have at the head of this organization a country that has not had a good experience developing in a sustainable way and is only now perhaps at an inflection point where it's understanding how to integrate environmental protection and economic development. So it's really going to, I think, require that both the recipient countries and the other countries involved in the lending process put the environment front and center as they sort of begin the process of investing and lending.
Well, speaking of that reflection point, we hear time to time that China finally is getting religion on climate environmental issues. Is that true? Are they getting religion? And how much of the corner has been turned?
I think they're getting religion. I think they're getting religion, although I doubt that Xi Jinping would like to put it that way unless the religion is the religion of the Communist Party. But I think they are... they've come to appreciate, I think, finally, the degree to which the environment is, you know, harming the people's health, is biting back into economic development, right? You don't have enough water to run your factories, or, you know, people are missing a lot of work because they're sick. So because of the environment, or, you know, you're losing all these crops, right, because your land is contaminated. So I think when they look at sort of the public health implications, the economic implications, and certainly social unrest, since the environment's the largest source of social unrest in the country, I think the leadership, yes, has gotten religion. And again, the only question is, you know, as they're pushing forward on economic reform, you know, as the Chinese economy slows, that can have some benefits for the environment. You know, we've seen a pretty, you know, significant drop, or I should say, you know, a slowing in any case of the growth in coal consumption in China over the past year or so. So that's a positive. But, you know, it can also mean that as they're, you know, pushing forward on the economy, that the environment again takes second place because nothing is more important still than economic growth. So I think we'll have to wait to see. You know, the proof is in the pudding. I'm cautiously optimistic that we are at a new stage of Chinese, you know, economic and environmental development. But I think we'll have to see over the next year or two, you know, the extent to which China really begins to integrate environmental protection into its economic development. It has a lot of challenges in this regard.
That was Elizabeth Economy, Director of the Asia Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Machine from Vespers for a New Dark Age by the Brooklyn-based composer Missy Mazzoli, performed by Victoire. Till next week, bye.